KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Good evening to you, everyone. It's Mike Hagan. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Good to be with you tonight. It's about 6 minutes now after 11 p.m. on the 4th of June. And we do this every Monday night for 3 hours, from 11 p.m. until 2 a.m. in the morning, every Monday. And before we get things going every Monday, we say thank you to Debbie Johnson. Free Range Radio Theater every week. Great stuff. on the air. Kelvin and Jason, Jazz Plus Blues equals From the Heart before Debbie every week. Tech Radio, they start things off at 6 o'clock or so. Amazing information, as always, about the fast-evolving world of high technology. Jeff Wheeler starts things off every Monday at 3 p.m., goes until 5. Good music, good talk, good news. Just good radio on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be here with you and a part of it all. All right, thanks to everyone who listened and participated in the program last week. A wonderful woman, Elaine Matthews, was with us. We thank her very much. The Heartbeat of Intelligence, this great book that Elaine has written. And once again, big thank you to Elaine Matthews for being on the program and for doing the work that she does, work from the heart. And she's got a damn good one. So thanks, Elaine. I love you. All right, thanks also to Michael and Star. We had a chance to talk to Michael Heisen, Dr. Michael Heisen and Star Newland for a couple of minutes last week about some of the business that's going down in the International Whaling, was it the IWC, International Whaling Commission? Yeah, that's what it is, I guess, right? Anyway, the IWC, we had a message to send to the people over there last week, and we did it here on Orbit, and I'm glad that we were able to help out the message of the Cetacea last week. So, anyway, I hope you enjoyed the show, and I did, and we also had music from Void's Anatomy, wonderful band, with a woman named Marie Georges from Canada. If you missed the show or the music, it's all on the web, www.mikehagan.com. And just find your way over there to the program archives, all right? Okay, tonight, Gary David. Gary A. David. He's written a very interesting book. It's called The Orion Zone. And we'll be talking about star patterns, constellations, and their connections to the indigenous peoples of the American Southwest, the Hopi primarily, the Anasazi, the Maya to a certain extent. And we'll be talking with Gary in just a little bit at the top of the hour here at midnight. But The Orion Zone is his book, and it's also the name of his website. So if you're interested in seeing what's going on, before we get to Gary at the top of the hour, just go over to Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com, and click on the link over there to Gary's website. Or you can link over there directly at The Orion Zone, TheOrionZone.com. All right? Okay, we also, tonight, will have music from the Starlings. Great band that I ran into on Friday evening. Well, actually, I didn't run into them. I didn't want to hurt them. But I saw them playing music on Friday night. They actually had a gig down at the Fugue on 9th Street. But I have sort of an interesting story about the Starlings. It was Thursday night last week, and I was downtown. My wife and children were out of town for a few days, and so I had the chance to get out a little bit, and maybe it was Wednesday night, I forget. But anyway, I was out and was downtown having a few beers with some friends, and there's a certain place behind the Blue Fugue that's sort of in between the Fugue and CC's City Broiler. There's a couple of parking lots back there, and there's this little concrete wall that's about 2.5 feet high, and we always go down there and sit there. And it's a great place to just go out and go out and have a smoke, because you can't smoke in the bar, you know. So we go out on the back. We call it the stoop. So we go out to the back of the bar there, and we go over to the stoop, and we sit down and we have a smoke. So I went out there on Wednesday or Thursday night with my friend Chris and a few other people to just get outside for a few minutes. And anyway, we saw right there in the corner of this little area where we like to go, there was a bird, a dead bird that had, was, I don't know exactly what had happened to it, but was laying there sort of dead in the corner between this little concrete wall and the building that it's attached to. And I'm sort of partial to birds, you know. I love all birds. I love animals in general, and I love sort of everything that moves, essentially, or that doesn't. But anyway, birds are just at the top of my list, red-tailed hawk in particular. But down to the smallest of flying things, you know, I'm just very interested in that stuff. So anyway, we sat down, and speak of the devil, he walks in right now. So we sat down on our little stoop, this little area where we like to hang out and have a smoke, and my friend Chris said, "Oh, look, there's a dead bird there in the corner." And I said, "Oh, yeah, it is." And he said, "Ah, it's just a starling. Just a POS starling, a flying rat." I forget what he, I think he called it that. And I said, "What are you going to get this poor starling, you know, man? Get over it." And we sort of went back and forth a little bit about it, just joking around, and then went on with our business, and we had a smoke, and then we went back into the bar. And so anyway, I had been thinking about this starling, this bird, that was laying out there, and I was in the bar for another hour and a half or so, and when I left, I thought, you know, I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to take that starling, and I'm going to move it, and I'm going to go put it somewhere, you know, more dignified, and then I thought, well, when my friends go back out there a little bit later to have another smoke, then they'll freak out because they'll see that the starling has gone, and they'll think it was, like, revivified or something, right? So this is exactly what happened. They went out there a little bit later, and one of my friends called me on the phone and said, "Mike, you won't freaking believe what happened." And we went out there an hour later, and the starling was gone. So anyway, it was me, you know. But that's okay. On Friday night, fast forward a couple days or a day, and I go back to the Blue Fugue on Friday night, and I walked into the bar. It was late, about midnight or so. And guess who's taking the stage? A band called the Starlings. They're from Seattle. And anyway, that's who you just heard starting off the show. And that song was called Alaskan Fire, and it's from a CD that they were kind enough to give to me on Friday when I met them, and it's called Songbook. And so we'll hear music all night tonight from the Starlings. And we'll do another one here in just a few minutes. I want to say hi to my friend Chris and his little sister who just walked in, and we'll come back and talk to you all in a few minutes here. As I said, we've got Gary David coming up tonight. We'll talk about the Hopi and their connection to certain constellations and star patterns up there in the heavens above your head. And we'll do space weather in just a little while. We'll do some news before we talk with Gary. And I don't know. You know, music, I should also mention that, you know, information about all the musicians that I feature on the program is available on the website as well. Just slip on over there to Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. And click on the music archives, and from there you'll be able to you know, find information and downloads and all kinds of stuff about the different bands that we're playing. Okay? All right, this song is called Long Black Veil, and we'll come back in just a few minutes, and I'll talk a little bit more with you. In the meantime, the Starlings on Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia. Lord, like All right, that's Long Black Veil. The band is called The Starlings. And I'm called Mike. Mike Hagan. And the radio show that you're listening to is called Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we're going to do it up tonight like we always do every Monday. Got a guy named Gary David coming up in just a little while. We're going to talk about the constellation Orion and some other ones and the connection to the indigenous people down there in the American Southwest, the Hopi. And it's going to be a fun show, so stick around. Hello to everybody listening to us this evening on KOPN, either through the traditional airwaves or over the web, live or otherwise. Every Monday we broadcast a show from the lovely studios here of KOPN in downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we stream the show live as well on the web at kopn.org. You can just zip on over there on the World Wide Web and click on the Listen Live button. If you do that, you will get a nice 64K stream. And we can also be heard live on the web via Cosmic Waves Radio Network. That's on the web at www.cosmicwavesradio.com. And in fact, I actually have to get the stream going for Cosmic Waves tonight. I was a little bit late tonight, and I haven't actually initialized that. I'll do it when we take the next break. At any rate, thanks to everybody at both places, KOPN and Cosmic Waves, to make it happen for us live on the air and live on the Internet. All right. Also, thank you to the people out there who have been sending art and music and poetry. New stuff in the Poets Corner, wonderful stuff, send more. I like it, and we'll find a place for it on the website. The music that I've been getting is wonderful, and I've been finding a lot of great local stuff, regional stuff as well. So we've got a lot of good music coming up over the next few weeks. Check it out. If you've got something you want to send me, just do it. Easy to get a hold of me. Go over to the website, and you'll have access to my email and post something on the forum, or you can send me something in snail mail, whatever, okay? Anyway, go on over there to the website at MikeHagan.com. Take a look what we're doing over there and share your thoughts, okay? There's a forum, bulletin board sort of business that is active all the time. Monday nights is when we do the show, but the forum's active all week. Lots of interesting stories from the news and, well, who knows what will be up there these days, but there's lots of people that sort of hang out there during the day and post different stories about this, that, and the other thing, and then you can, you know, add your comments and questions and debate them or whatever you feel like, okay? Anyway, lots going on at the forum always, and I can't keep up with it anymore, but I post the stuff that I can when I get a chance. The live chat room is up and active. As we do every Monday night, there's a live chat. A little bit different tonight. I wasn't real happy with the chat module that we're using. A lot of people are getting kicked off over the last few weeks, so we're trying something different tonight. I'm actually not in there right now because for whatever reason, when I go in there, I get some funky audio signal that comes through my board. So hopefully people over there that are listening to the program are enjoying the new chat. I'll figure out what's going on with the audio next week, but I'm not going to mess with it tonight, okay? All right, speaking of that, we'll encourage guests and listeners, you know, to join us over there in the chat room and in the forum. It's a great way to get to know other people and find out what people are saying about your stuff if you're a guest, okay? All right, my email address, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio at AOL.com. And you can send me email. I appreciate it. Criticism's welcome as well, you know, and anything you want to tell me. Be interested in checking it out, and I'll try to respond if I can. Guests and musicians that are on the program, they always welcome your feedback as well. It's easy to get a hold of them. Most of them can be contacted through their websites, and you can always get to their websites through my site. And some of them, you know, if you can't get a hold of them, just send something to me, and I'll be sure to forward, okay? All right, the phone number here in the studio is 573-443-8255. I'm not sure if we'll take any phone calls later in the program. But if we do, 573-443-8255, that'll be the number you call, and we'll be happy to talk to you if that's what we decide to do, okay? Tonight, as I mentioned, Gary David, Orion and the Hopi. His book is called The Orion Zone. We'll talk with him in just a few minutes, all right? About 35, actually. All right, what else? Neil Adams, next week. Guy who has got this. Now, this is a real serious scientific type guy we're going to talk to next week, and he has this amazing theory of what he calls the growing earth theory. You know, we've all had this idea taught to us in school, at least I did, about what they call Pangaea. And it was, you know, millennia ago, thousands of millennia ago, supposedly, you know, back in the early days of the earth when all of the continents were somehow together in one landmass. And then over time, you know, we're taught that by the action of tectonic plates and geothermal activity within the earth, that slowly the landmass split apart and separated until, you know, it was what we see today. And even, you know, as a young kid, I remember thinking, looking at the globe. We used to have one of those spinning globes, you know, that was in my big sister's bedroom or whatever, you know, that had all the countries and things like that. And I remember just as a 8 or 9 year old kid thinking, oh, well, it's pretty obvious that all those things fit together. I mean, I remember thinking, you know, seeing the African coastline and then, you know, looking at North and South America and the European landmass and just sort of visually bringing them together, and it all sort of worked, and you could sort of see how at one time things probably were closer together. But what Neil Adams says is that plate tectonics has been disproven, and there's quite a bit of evidence that there's... Look, if plate tectonics is really... If something like that is really happening, they got a lot of explaining to do, because this whole idea of subduction zones and all that is total BS. There are no subduction zones. The so-called subduction zones are kicking out material. And so, anyway, Neil Adams basically says that the Earth was smaller and that it's just growing, essentially, like a living organism. And, you know, there's plenty of talk these days about the Earth as, you know, a sentient living creature, the whole Gaia concept and all this. So maybe it's not that far of a stretch to think of the Earth as a growing organism. You know, it's just the time frames are different than we might be used to as humans. But, of course, if you're a fruit fly, you know, your time frame is 3 days. That's your lifespan. So everything happens in 3 days. So this idea of time is one that we sort of take, you know, in a much more culturally conventional sense than we ever really believe that we do. Time is as relative and time is absolutely relative to, you know, the length of your own individual lifespan, not to mention the species that's involved in it. So anyway, there's a whole lot going on, but this idea of the growing Earth theory is one that we're going to talk with Neil Adams about next week. And like I say, he's not a... I looked pretty deeply into what he's been saying, and he's a very serious scientist, and he's really shaken up a few people. He is really shaking up some people. So we'll talk with him next week and let him air it out. If you guys have questions, you know, obviously we'll just let him have it and see how he answers them. So anyway, next week, that's what's happening. Growing Earth Theory, Neil Adams. Next, let's see, the week after that, what's that? It'll be the 18th of June. Peter Light. We'll talk about permaculture. I have a good friend whose name is Lance, who's participating in the forum quite a bit and knows a whole lot of these guys, like Richard Allen Miller and some of the old gang that Terrence used to hang out with. And he's a great resource and a really cool guy. And Lance set me up, or introduced me, I guess I should say, to Peter Light. And Peter is a real interesting fella and an expert on what they call permaculture. And we'll talk with Peter about that in a couple weeks, okay? What else? The 25th of June, I have something sort of special planned, but it'll be me by myself, unless something falls in there. On the 2nd of July, we'll have Richard Allen Miller back. By popular demand, I should say. I got all kinds of mail about Richard. So we'll have Rick Miller back on the 2nd of July. Patrick Flanagan, still working on that. Dr. Richard Tarnas, working on that. John Major Jenkins, he'll be on very soon. Dennis, I talked with Dennis just a few weeks ago, and I'm not exactly sure what Dennis is doing this summer. He may be leaving and going down to Iquitos for a while in Peru, but we're going to talk at the end of this month and try to get Dennis on the air sometime before the end of summer. That's Dennis McKenna, for people who aren't familiar with the program. Anyway, lots going on as always. Good music coming up as well, and we'll just have a good summer. We've got that planned for sure. I think the summer's going to be awesome. All right? Speaking of that, I have a couple of announcements that I want to make. To start the summer off right, actually it's sort of a midsummer party. It's a solstice party that we're going to do at my place. We do it every year around the summer solstice, which is usually the 21st or the 22nd, sometimes the 23rd of June, depending on the you know, the now defunct Gregorian calendar. But regardless, this year it'll be the 23rd of June. It's a Saturday at our land in Roachport. And if you're listening to this program, you're welcome. So, you know, just figure out how to get there. But that's happening on June 23rd. The solstice, a lot of people think that the summertime starts on the 21st of June. But it's actually not when summer starts. Summer starts at what they call the cross-quarter date, in between the equinox, which is the 21st, 22nd of March, you know, the spring equinox, and the summer solstice, which is the 22nd of June. So you have 3 months there, essentially. In between is May 1st, May Day. And May Day is essentially the beginning of summer. The solstice is the day that summer peaks. It's the midpoint of summer. Remember the Shakespearean play that was called A Midsummer Night's Dream? Well, that was what they were talking about. It was the middle of summer. And that's sort of a confusing thing to a lot of people these days, because I think it's celebrated in our culture that summer begins on June 21st, but actually that's sort of the high point of summer. And it begins at the beginning of May. So at any rate, the midsummer solstice party will be held in Roachport at the Shire, a place where me and my family love to hang and welcome all of our friends out there. So come and join us, all right? Be there or be square. All right, Carl Jung, my most favorite psychiatrist and philosopher to a certain extent, passed away on the 6th of June in 1961. Carl Gustav Jung. He was a Swiss depth psychologist, psychiatrist, the founder of what they called analytical psychology. Most people would know him for his contributions for things like the concepts of the archetype of the unconscious or the collective unconscious, he used to talk about. And my favorite thing, one of my favorites certainly, that Jung introduced me too, was synchronicity, the concept of synchronicity, which is one that is becoming more and more apparent to me every single day. And Jung was also interested in things like alchemy. He was a real esoteric at heart, and this is why his ideas are, for the most part, not taught in most of the major universities' psych departments. They look at him in the humanities sometimes, but for the most part, Jung doesn't get near the attention he should because Jung's ideas essentially bring down the house, you know, on humanism and positivism and scientism and, you know, a lot of other isms. But he was very interested in alchemy and astrology and literature of the arts, and just a wonderfully intelligent and brilliant man who contributed a tremendous amount to the fields of psychiatry and psychology. So Carl Jung, here's to you, my brother. And he wrote lots of different books, but one of my favorites was called, you know, very few people realize that he was interested in the whole flying saucer phenomenon from a psychological standpoint. And he wrote this amazing book in 1952 that was called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. And to this day, it is, and I've read all this stuff. I've read every freaking alien theory. I've read the religious ideas, you know, that it's the demons flying. I've read them all. I've read books since I was 9 years old, and I'm a lot older than that now. And Carl Jung's book on the saucers is, to my mind, still the best explanation of what's happening. I mean, people are seeing something. It's been going on for a long time. And, you know, Jacques Vallée has gotten a piece of the puzzle too, I think. But at any rate, if you're interested in the saucer phenomenon or the UFO phenomenon, and I'm not talking about the ones that are, you know, U.S. government sponsored. I'm talking about the ones that motivated the U.S. government and the Nazis and all these other clowns, you know, to try to do what they have now probably accomplished to a certain extent. But at any rate, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky by Carl Jung, just an incredible book that will make you think twice about couple of things. Anyway, Leslie Kasloff, another wonderful man who was an influence on me, an herbalist who knew more about plants than most anyone that I ever sort of came across. He died on the 8th of June, 6 years ago in 2001, in New York City. He wasn't that old. He was only 58 years old. But he was involved in the herb industry when it was sort of up and coming, before it got co-opted by the pharmaceutical, you know, petrochemical industry. But they're probably the ones that killed him. Actually, I don't know that, and I probably shouldn't even imply that. But anyway, he did a couple of things that I just really appreciated. In 1972, he made this what was called the Herb and Ailment Cross-Reference Chart. And it was this big, like, poster. It was, like, probably 4 feet wide and 5 feet high. And it was hand-drawn. He did the whole thing by hand. And he drew pictures of hundreds of medicinal herbs and flowers on this huge sort of, you know, this big poster thing. And then in, like, you know, the most beautiful, smallest of handwriting, he documented all over this. It's like a big piece of artwork is what it was, essentially. But he documented all of these different ailments and then how to use all of these different herbs and flowers and plants to deal with any of these particular conditions. And I mean, I have a copy of this thing in my house, and it is, just to see it is really cool, but there's also a tremendous amount of valuable information in there. Long before the advent of the pharmaceutical drug pushers, you know, the way people got healthy was through the plants, and a tremendous amount of that knowledge has been forgotten, but it's not that hard to get it back. The plants are willing to give that knowledge to us at any time, whenever you decide to get it from them. But guys like Les Kasloff, you know, immortalized it in the amazing works of art and information that he made, including this this amazing cross-reference chart of herbs and ailments that he did in 1972. So he also wrote a bunch of books like that, Holistic Dimensions in Healing, and he did the whole Bach, the Bach Remedy series with, what was it, Ellen Books, the Ellen Company, I think, was his publishing company. At any rate, Leslie Kasloff, all right, and Carl Jung, to both of you. Appreciate everything you did for us, all right? We're trying not to forget. Let's see, what else we got going here? About 20 minutes before the hour, I think what we'll do here, we'll come back and we'll do space weather, tell you what's happening up there on the sun and the stars. And in the meantime, I'll play another song from the Starlings, and then we'll come back with Gary David at the top of the hour, okay? So let's get a piece of music on here. I can call David, get him on the horn, and then we'll talk about some other things before the top of the hour there, okay? All right, let's see. What are we going to play here? How about Angel to Rise? Great little song here from the Starlings. Again, the song Angel to Rise, the CD is called Songbook, and the band is called the Starlings. This is Mike Hagen, and you are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. I know you know I'm here. angel to rise, that is starlings. And my name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and a world of music. It's good to be with you here tonight. And let's just move right along here, okay? We talked about Carl Jung. We talked a little bit about Les Kasloff. And a couple wonderful people that we're going to sort of dedicate the show to tonight. There's another man that I'm going to dedicate the show to tonight a little bit later, but we'll mention his name at the top of the hour here when we bring our guest on. In the meantime, let's do space weather, okay? Beautiful full moon last Thursday, Friday. New moon about a week and a half from now. There's quite a strong solar wind stream right now that's buffeting up against the Earth's magnetic field right now. You're going to get pretty cool geomagnetic storms up there in the north. We played that song Alaskan Fire at the beginning of the program. That's sort of appropriate tonight probably because you're going to get some good aurora borealis up there in the northern hemispheres. All you high latitude sky watchers, you know, keep your eyes up for aurora. Going to be nice up there for the next couple of days. The sun, which is causing all this stuff, is in the middle of transiting this big, giant sunspot across the surface right now. There have been a number of big flares. It was a big M9 just yesterday, and certainly the potential for even bigger flares over the next 24 or 48 hours or so. But this particular sunspot, I think, has been designated number 960. And if you're interested in it and looking at pictures and all that stuff of it, you can do that on the web at spaceweather.com. And I also advise you to take a peek over there at Kent Stedman's website, cyberspaceorbit.com. Kent's always following the solar activity pretty closely. But the sun really getting excited for the last few days, and to the point where it knocked out some communications equipment on the other side of the planet and a whole bunch of stuff just a few days ago. So anyway, there is some wonderful sites up there. The photography that's being done now these days, you know, high technology is expressing itself in every way, shape, and form. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter if you play music or if you take pictures of the sun or if you're a computer builder or, you know, if you make shoes. The ability to do all these things is getting better because of, you know, the advancement of technology. Well, man, some of the imagery that's coming down from the sun, from amateur photographers, it's just remarkable. And a lot of this stuff is being posted up on the web. So you can see some great stuff up there these days. And there's some interesting halos that have been photographed around the sun over the last few days. The sun always, you know, has an interesting environment outside of itself. They call it the heliosphere, you know, the whole entire ball of wax, the whole solar system, they call the heliosphere. And it's just basically this big egg-shaped sphere that has the sun in the center of it, but everything inside that sphere is just, you know, very, very powerfully connected to the sun and affected by everything that happens on the sun, whether you think it is or not, including ourselves. You know, the sun is just such a huge percentage of the energy and the mass of the whole solar system, you know, over 99% of everything. Add up all the planets, all the asteroids, all the comets, all the debris in between Jupiter and Mars, all of it. It's less than 0.5%. The sun is 99.5% of everything. So if the sun burps, it affects everything, whether you think it does or not. And that's why we pay attention to it. Because it's interesting. It's like when you start to pay attention to something, then you actually start to understand it better. And things can, you know, cycle. The sun goes through cycles. And you can actually start to correlate the cycles of the sun to things like, you know, people have been correlating the sun to all kinds of different cycles, economic cycles, cycles of war and peace, cycles of extinction, you know, and the blossoming of life, all these different things. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, how legitimate this, that, or the other theory are, but certainly the sun is a major affect on us and every minute of every day. And you'll know it as soon as it blinks out. Right? So anyway, go take a look at the sun. He'd love it. June 4th. What time is it? 10 minutes. Let's see. You've got a couple things here. June 4th, the direct detection of planets and circumstellar disks in the 21st century. This is a conference going on at Berkeley for the next few days. Tomorrow, that probe was, I think it's a NASA combined probe with ESA, with the European Space Agency. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. But anyway, they're flying by Venus tomorrow. So there should be some interesting, what do they call it, telemetry. We'll use the technical term. There'll be some interesting telemetry coming back from the MESSENGER probe over the next few days, and hopefully some interesting imagery, and who knows what else from that. That's happening literally now over the next 24 hours. There's also a conference going on in Bavaria right now, where I used to live, called the Conference on Obscured AGN. AGN, that stands for Active Galactic Nucleus. This is the only reason why I tell people these things, because I think they're just so silly sometimes just to say them. This is the Conference on Obscured Active Galactic Nuclei Across Cosmic Time. I tell you what, man, these guys got a lot they're talking about. I don't think they have a clue what they're talking about. That's what I think. I don't think anyone has a clue. Jupiter's at opposition. I know that on June 6th. STS-117, the space shuttle, is going to launch on the 8th. Going to go put up some stuff on the International Space Station, supposedly. We have our usual comets and asteroids zipping by. A whole bunch of them, as always. Venus at elongation, eastern elongation, in the next few days, on the 9th, actually. And then the Grand Canyon Star Party is going on in Arizona. And I mention that because our guest for this evening, Gary David, will be talking about things of the Southwest. And in the Grand Canyon, there's all kinds of mysteries, you know, but there's a tremendous amount of mystery in the Southwest United States. The Grand Canyon has its own mysteries. And I actually, I'm not sure if Gary's involved with some of this stuff, but I'll have to ask him about this whole Grand Canyon thing. But at any rate, there's a Grand Canyon Star Party that is going on the whole week, from the 9th until the 16th. And, you know, get your butt on down there to Arizona, and you can stare at the stars with a bunch of other people. All right. I got a few more minutes here. Night Sky Notes. As I said, the MESSENGER spacecraft is going to be flying by Venus tomorrow on the 5th. And it's actually going to Mercury. That's what the mission is, actually a Mercury mission. But they use these other planets for, you know, to help the spacecraft maneuver. They use the planets to slingshot this way and that way because they only have a certain amount of fuel that they use, and they like to use gravity to move these things around the solar system. But at any rate, MESSENGER was launched on the 3rd of the 3rd of August in 2004, and it's sort of winding its way around the solar system, eventually to Mercury, which it should arrive to in 2011, so still quite a long time before it gets there. It's making quite a few stops in between. But MESSENGER will get about 190 miles away from the surface of Venus. And like I say, hopefully we'll have some interesting information come back from that. Jupiter at opposition tomorrow. A planet is at opposition when it is opposite from the sun in our sky. So if you sort of picture the sun in your head and you picture the Earth whipping around the sun, well, wherever the Earth is on that side of the sun, picture Jupiter in its orbit on the other side of the sun, as far away from the Earth as it could be. That's what they call opposition. And when a planet is at opposition, it actually rises around sunset and sets in the morning time, the early morning time. So you'll be able to see Jupiter all night long, pretty much during the summertime. Well, I tell you what, I think we're going to take a minute here, play a piece of music. We'll come back at the top of the hour with Gary David. You can find information about Gary and the stuff we'll be talking about on the web at www.theorionzone.com, and you can link there directly from my site. There's a link right up there on my front page. Gary has done some very interesting work and is continuing to do the work, I'm certain, on the indigenous peoples of Southwest America and their relationship to the stars. And they were very interested in what was happening up there and have not, frankly, been given near the amount of credit for the expertise that they had with regard to, you know, celestial mechanics and the movement of the stars and the relationship between the heavens and the earth. So we'll do a little bit of archaeoastronomy tonight with Gary David, the author of The Orion Zone. And I'm really looking forward to it, okay? All right, it's about 6 minutes to the top of the hour. We'll take a break here, play a little bit of music, come back, and do it up with Gary David, author of The Orion Zone. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is a song called Bones to Ashes. Once again, the Starlings. And information on the Starlings can be found on the web at starlingsmusic.com. And you can link there from my site as well. We'll have something up for them in the music archives after the program, okay? And as always, the archives of the show are available to anybody who's interested in checking them out. And the MP3 of this particular program that we're recording right now will be up and on the web hopefully sometime tomorrow afternoon or tomorrow evening, okay? So you can download it and share it with your friends or whatever if you missed the program tonight, okay? All right, one more time, Bones to Ashes. This is the Starlings on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. Back in just a few minutes with Gary David.
You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
That's right, this is Mike Hagan. You are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. My guest tonight, his name is Gary A. David. He's been interested and intrigued by the Four Corners region of the United States for many, many years, following a trip in the late 1980s. He has written an amazing book that's called The Orion Zone, Ancient Star Cities of the American Southwest. It has to do with the ancient ancestral Puebloans and the descendants of the Hopi. His articles have appeared in Ancient American and Atlantis Rising and in Fate Magazine, as a matter of fact, and a number of other publications. And we're very pleased to have him with us tonight on the program, and we'll waste no more time and say hello and welcome to Radio Orbit to Gary David. Hi there.
Thanks, Mike, for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for being here. Look, Gary, for the people who aren't familiar with your work, and myself included, I usually like to start things off with a little bit of background about our guests. So maybe to start things off, you could talk a little bit about yourself and where you come from and how you got interested in this particular part of the world and, you know, why it struck you so. And then we'll get a little bit further into the things that are actually happening down there.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah. Wow.
And not too many Native Americans are still around in that area.
Yeah.
There are a few Cleveland Indians, but that's about it.
Right. Serpent Mound up there, not too far, though.
Yeah, Serpent Mound is an amazing amazing structure in southern Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
In fact, the Hopi, the Snake Clan of the Hopi claim to have built that in their migrations to the east.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. But anyway, okay.
But I really started my interest in Native Americans. I moved to South Dakota in the late 70s.
Oh, man.
And I was living in the Black Hills area and got to know some Native Americans and started to go to some of the ceremonies. I witnessed the sun dance mm-hmm. on the Rosebud Reservation.
Oh, man. Gary, I was in Pine Ridge in February.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's been a long time since I've been up there. I used to teach at Pine Ridge. I taught at Oglala Lakota College.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they have a branch in Rapid City and another branch in Oglala on the reservation. So I used to go there and teach English on the reservation, and you know, spent a lot of years studying the culture and being exposed to different facets of the culture.
Wow, that's so cool!
I had the honor of meeting Charlotte Black Elk.
Huh.
She's the great granddaughter
of
the famous Nicholas Black Elk.
Sure.
John Neihardt.
Sure. Sure. Black Elk Speaks.
Sure. Yeah, it's a great classic work. But she's doing some amazing work herself, and believe it or not, it has to do with archaeoastronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a hide, a star map on a hide. It shows the position of the stars thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she's trying to come forth with the idea that the Lakota Sioux were in the area long before the historians say they were.
I believe it.
And they have a claim to the Black Hills, which is really genuine. And she's in the process of trying to prove that. And she's working with some people at Santa Gleska College on the Rosebud. And Ron Goodman has written a wonderful book about archaeoastronomy and the Lakota. And
you know, Gary, I have a wonderful book that's called Lakota Star Knowledge. That I forget the author of it right now, but you know, Wallace Black Elk was a friend of mine, my grandfather.
Oh, really?
Wallace,
yeah.
I don't know if you knew Wallace, but
no.
But he was he spent most of his elder years in Colorado. But he was from Rosebud, you know.
Yeah, I read his book, you know.
Yeah, and he was just a remarkable, remarkable person, and one of the most influential people in my own life that I mean, to this day, I love my grandfather Wallace. I miss it. I miss him tremendously. He died in the winter of 2003.
I love the spirit of the Lakota people. They have such a vibrant warrior spirit.
Oh man,
they're just a beautiful people. And I met Charlotte Black Elk, and we did. It's kind of funny the way I ran into her. We were trying to fight the Honeywell Corporation in their plans to put a bomb testing site in the Black Hills. Mm-hmm. This was in 1987.
Okay.
And I was working with a group called the CIA. It's an ad hoc group, and we call ourselves the CIA, the Cowboy and Indian Alliance.
I like it.
And we got some of the Lakota interested and brought it to their attention that this Honeywell Corporation from Minneapolis was planning to put a massive bomb testing site with radioactive tipped munitions right in the sacred Black Hills. And so we fought this thing, and we got Charlotte involved, and we started doing they had an encampment down at the site where the corporation was going to bring in the bombs, you know. There was a teepee encampment, and we had sweat lodges down there, and it was a wonderful show of strength from the Lakota people to defend the Black Hills, the Pahasapa.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in South Dakota for about 15 years, and then I decided to move down to after a trip down to the Southwest. I decided to move to Arizona.
Okay.
And I've lived in Arizona for about a little over 12 years.
As of now.
Yeah.
Okay. See what? All right. So, what drew you down there? In other words, you were obviously, you've been interested in Native peoples or Indigenous people for a long time. But what took you from the Plains Indians down to the Pueblo?
The Hopi are a totally different tribe. The Hopi, the character is very different from the Lakota. The Hopi are agrarian, they're farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Lived a sedentary life, more or less. You see some of the movies, you see the John Wayne films of Monument Valley, and you see Plains Indians, riding across Monument Valley, which is kind of funny to watch, you know. These Indians are way out of place, you know.
Right.
Hundreds of miles north and a few miles east, you know. but the Hopi live in stone villages. There are many ruined sites that are national monuments that you could visit today. You can go up to the Hopi mesas. The Hopi still perform their sacred ceremonies on an annual cyclic kind of basis.
Mm-hmm.
So it just kind of drew me in. The whole different feel of people who've lived in a place for a very long time. They weren't nomadic. They, stayed in one place, though they made migrations too over the centuries. But they were more sedentary than the Sioux, which made, kind of annual migrations around the Black Hills.
Right. All right, so you went down there in 1987 or so, right?
No, I've been to, moved to Arizona in 1994.
Okay. Your first trip that was down there was like in 87.
Right, yeah. I made a brief trip, and that kind of settled it for me to come down here.
All right, so what'd you find when you got down there?
Well, I started going to some of the Kachina dances on the Hopi mesas.
Kachina's an interesting concept. Why don't you talk about that before you...
Okay,
Let's explain Kachina before we talk about the dances.
Kachina, some of your listeners might have seen Kachina dolls that... the Hopi carve. Kachina is basically a spirit messenger, and the Hopi perform dances from about April until after the summer solstice in mid-July, and they perform these ceremonies to honor the Kachinas. And there are many different types of Kachinas. It's very difficult to talk about Kachinas because there are so many different types. There's so many different types of shapes of masks and costumes. There's nothing uniform about the kachinas. Usually, if they're having a dance, it'll be one type of kachina that they're honoring,
mm-hmm.
or say maybe a parrot dance, you know, the parrot kachina, which is kind of a strange concept because parrots are not indigenous to the Southwest, but you know they still have parrot dances, and of course there are corn kachinas and different all various types of kachinas.
Okay.
Different villages sponsor dances. And they're held mostly on the weekends because the Hopi have to juggle, you know, the process of making a living with the ceremonial cycle, which I imagine if you're a very strict Hopi as far as religion is concerned, it'd be very difficult because the ceremonies take so much time to prepare for and so much time to do throughout the year, and you have to keep this cycle going. Or, you know, if you don't keep the cycle going, the ceremonial cycle going, then the whole culture kind of breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, this is starting to happen. There are fewer and fewer young people learning Hopi language and learning the customs, and they're moving off to Phoenix and other big cities to get work. And the culture is starting to, the ceremonies are starting to deteriorate. And I have a Hopi friend that thinks that perhaps that maybe in 50 years the ceremonial cycle will be dead
on the
Hopi reservation. I really hope not. That's kind of a pessimistic assessment, but
well, maybe I could ask you just a little bit of a side note here while it's on my mind. There's a special man that I knew who was a Hopi grandfather. His name was we call him Grandfather Martin, and I have a difficult time with his last name. It's like Gashwisioma.
That's pretty close. I've never met him. A friend of mine knows Grandfather Martin.
Oh, man.
And has talked with him and more than once. His name is Chris O'Brien. He's also an author. He's
mm-hmm.
written about the San Luis Valley up in southern
in Colorado. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another really interesting place.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's so much. You know, it's funny, people tend to look like, you know, to Egypt or to South America or to China or wherever for, you know, for monuments and ancient earthwork and all this stuff. And there's so much right here in North America that it's outrageous.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, this monument, I would say a ceremonial monument, a monument of ceremony in terms of the Hopi. The Hopi weren't great pyramid builders or anything like that. They were kind of a humble people. They lived in these stone villages. They didn't live in teepees, you know.
Mm-hmm.
they lived in stone villages, and they didn't tend to make, like the Maya or the Aztecs, they didn't build pyramids. But their ceremonial cycle is so rich and so varied, so complex that it's almost like a monument, a temporal monument that continues throughout the year. I mean, it's really, from the outside, it's really hard to get a grasp on it because it is so complex.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was going to these kachina dances on the reservation, and
mm-hmm.
if you've driven up, you know, east of Flagstaff along I-40, it's kind of a desolate area, and you know, it's Winslow is nearby, and
mm-hmm.
and the Meteor Crater is an amazing formation out there too. But I was gazing up towards the Hopi mesas, and there are basically three Hopi mesas. The Hopi settled on these mesas in around 1100 A.D. They started aggregating on these three main mesas. And I had just read a book by Robert Bouval called The Orion Mystery.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And Bouval and Gilbert, Adrian Gilbert, they have the theory of the Orion Correlation Theory, which...
had to do with Giza, though, right?
Oh, yeah, it's the Giza Plateau. Mm-hmm. The three main pyramids on Giza correspond to the belt stars of Orion.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Khufu Pyramid, the Great Pyramid,
right.
Corresponds to Al-Nitak. And the middle pyramid, the Khafre, which is slightly smaller, it corresponds to Al-Nilam. And then the smallest, the Menkaure Pyramid,
mm-hmm.
Corresponds to Mintaka. And, you know, I had just read this book, and I was going up to the Hopi Mesas, and I thought, well, you know, maybe there's an Orion correlation right here in Arizona. You know, so I just kind of put that in the back of my mind.
Right.
And when I got home, I got out the maps, and I got out the sky chart, and I compared the two. And what I found really astonished me, because there was a star corresponding to each village that the Hopi had built. A ruined site or a village site kind of mirrored each star in the constellation. It was amazing that the pattern was so exact. It's kind of the old adage, as above, so below.
Right.
Ancient Hermetic maxim. I mean, it was really amazing the way that the earth mirrored the sky.
Yeah, I'm looking at, for people who are interested in seeing this stuff, hop on the web. There's a link on Gary's page. The website is The Orion Zone, theorionzone.com. But when you go to the front page there's a link that takes you over to the maps section of the website, and you can see exactly what Gary's talking about here. You get
a good idea from the maps. You know, you can see the Orion correlation constellation right next to this pattern on the Arizona desert, and they're very close. The angles are pretty exact. The correlation is right there, and there's, like I say, there's a ruined site or a Hopi village corresponding to every major star in the constellation, which, you know, I don't think Giza, the Orion correlation at Giza is even that good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just primarily
the number of stars involved.
Interesting. Before I ask you more about the star patterns, I want to ask a little bit more about the history before the Hopi. I've always been interested in the Anasazi. Is this a reasonable time to talk about them or no?
Yeah, the Anasazi is really, the word is a misnomer, really, because that's a Navajo word which means ancient enemies.
Uh-huh.
It's a Diné word.
Diné.
It kind of describes the Puebloan people. The archaeologists like to call them the Puebloan people. People who built pueblos or these stone apartment buildings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hopi have a word for their ancestors, and they call them Hizatsinom, or simply the ancient ones, the ancient people.
Mm-hmm.
Archaeologists have gotten away from using the term Anasazi, but, you know, it's been in use for so long that many people, you know, it's a term that they kind of pick up. But the Hopi see that their ancestors were essentially the Anasazi or the Hizatsinom. There's very little difference between the two groups.
What about the cave dwelling business? That seemed remarkable to me, like Chaco Canyon area and all that.
Chaco Canyon was a little bit earlier. It started up in the 900s and got going in the 11th century. I've been out there, and there are some pictures in my book of Chaco Canyon. And this is also part of the star correlation theory. Much to my surprise, if you go on the second map on my website, Chaco Canyon corresponds to Sirius, the major star in Canis Major, and it's the brightest star in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, Chaco Canyon is the largest pueblo ruins in the Southwest. And it's my belief that a people called the Chichimecs moved up from Mexico and settled at Chaco Canyon. The Chichimecs, the name literally means sons of the dog.
Hmm.
And you see the star Sirius is known as the dog star.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, the Chichimecs, brought some customs in and settled in there from Mexico. And their symbol is the bow and arrow, the Chichimec, and there are a lot of bow-shaped ruins in Chaco Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
The buildings are actually bow-shaped, shaped like a bow, or a big D, I guess.
Right, and this would sort of signify the bow of that's represented in the constellation Orion. Perhaps or not.
Well, that could be. Yeah. Like I said, if you look on the map, it's Canis Major or Sirius. It really represents the Chaco area.
Okay.
Then they started to build into Arizona. Canyon de Chelly was around 1050 AD. They started to build there. Pueblo, you know, they were living there a long time before that in smaller dwellings in these places. But these major ruin sites started around, you know, Canyon de Chelly 1050, and the three major Hopi mesas started around 1100 AD. And there's a site called Homolivi, which is near Winslow, Arizona, and that started a little later, maybe in 1250.
Right.
1250 or 1300, they were building around there. And as I said, there's a star in the constellation Orion corresponding to each one of these places.
And it extends further out, too, though, right? I mean, I'm looking at some of the other maps. If you page down a little bit, you can go quite a ways out from those first three mesas that you were talking about and go all the way out to, like, Mesa Verde in Colorado.
Yeah, you can go up that way. There's a line that goes from Walnut Canyon near east of Flagstaff, and it goes through the Middle Mesa on the Hopi Reservation. And it goes right into that Four Corners region where there are a lot of ruined sites in southwestern Colorado.
Hmm.
And this is, I call this in the book, I call this the chakra line, because there are a number of settlements that almost form a chakra system on the body of Orion in the Arizona desert.
Hmm.
And there are ruins right in a line going all the way up into Colorado, and then you can take this line, and going southwest, the line hits around the mouth of the Colorado River in southern Arizona, and there around the Arizona-California border, there are some lines called the geoglyphs, and these are kind of lines like the Nazca lines in Peru. So there are some interesting things going on in that area too. If you go into southern Arizona, but this template is really interesting. You know, if you're looking at the map, and I suggest your listeners, if you have a computer, go to the map and look at the way, for instance, the left arm of Orion reaches out and goes into Grand Canyon, and there's a bow or a shield that kind of rests inside Grand Canyon, and I think this is very important. Grand Canyon is sacred to the Hopi. It's the place that they think they emerged from the previous world.
Mm-hmm. From underground or something, right?
From underground, yes. They conceive of a number of worlds that have already taken place. There are eras.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Hopi believe that we're living currently at the end of the fourth world, or the fourth era. And this is very much like the Hindu Yuga cycle.
Yeah, these turning of ages sort of.
Kali
ideas.
Yuga. We're supposed to be in the Kali Yuga now, as far as the Hindus are concerned. But the Hopi, you know, believe that we're living at the end of the fourth world, but the third world is located actually in the Grand Canyon, in the subterranean place, and it's also the place where after death you go back to this place. So it's not a hellish place at all. It's a place of a great fertility, and in fact there's a god that lives in the underworld that kind of sends growth vibrations up through the earth, so the corn will take root. And
is this Masa?
This is Muingwa is another god. Masao is kind of a strange. We can talk about Masao a little later if you want.
Okay, yeah, we'll get to that a little bit later.
Yeah, yeah. But the Grand Canyon is very important to the Hopi. In years past, they had made a lot of migrations to the Grand Canyon to collect salt. It was kind of a ritualistic pilgrimage that they made.
Mm-hmm.
To collect salt in these caverns down there, and they call there's a place called the Sipapu, or Sipapuni, is the it's
on
placed
the river,
in
right?
the Grand Canyon, and I've seen on a Google Earth map, you can actually see this place. It's near the where the Little Colorado comes into mm-hmm. the main part of the Colorado in Grand Canyon,
mm-hmm.
and it's It's called a travertine dome. It's a big limestone kind of thing, formation, geological formation, and there's a hole in the center of it, you know, and you can see this from way high up in the satellite photographs. It's very very dangerous to go down there. I don't suggest that any of your listeners go down there. There were a number of hikers a few years ago. There were very experienced hikers living in Flagstaff, and they went into the Grand Canyon around this, very close to the Sipapu, and they were just washed away in a flash flood. So
wow.
In the summertime, you can really get some fierce, you know, very very strong thunderstorms and flash flooding through this area, and it's kind of a treacherous area to go down into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Before we take a break, I was intrigued by a story that I ran across years ago about an expedition, I think in like 1904 or 1908 or something like that, early 1900s, where there was an interesting find of some caves and artifacts in the Grand Canyon, and the Smithsonian was involved and National Geographic and all this stuff. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. In fact, a good friend of mine, Jack Andrews, is the primary researcher on this. He's got a website, mysteriousarizona.com, that has a lot of information about this this expedition. It was in 1909, April of 1909, and a man named Kincaid took a boat from Green River, Wyoming, and he sailed it down the Colorado River and got off at Yuma, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
But he found this amazing site, which it's really kind of, you know, you just have to shake your head. You know, you wonder if it could really be true, because he found this. It was about 2,000 feet above the river, the riverbed. So he had to climb quite a ways up the cliff to get to this cave. He saw this cave, and when he went into the cave, it was a huge cavern. And the passageway seemed to be carved, and it was like 10, 12 feet wide. And it went back hundreds and hundreds of feet. And he apparently found this article that appeared in the Arizona Gazette.
Right. I've seen the photocopy of it already.
Yeah, there were all these copper tools and swords and weapons, different sorts of weapons, and there was kind of an idol of a figure that looked like a Buddha in a lotus posture, a statue. And there were evidence of smelters, copper smelting. There were, he found a type of hieroglyphs similar to Egyptian hieroglyphs. There he found stone tablets. He even found mummies, a crypt with a room with mummies kind of arranged along the wall. And it's just such an amazing story. I wish we could verify it, but
and it was never seen again or something.
Well, I have a feeling that the Smithsonian wanted to keep it quiet, because that would have blown out of the water their whole paradigm for the way archaeology is done. I mean, you just don't have these kinds of ruins in the American Southwest, look kind of Egyptian and kind of Oriental. You know, this was a huge place. It was some estimate that, you know, 50,000 people could have lived in these caverns. I mean, it was huge. They had a huge dining hall, and And it was just amazing, kind of thing. And there, like I say, there's a lot of information on Jack Andrews' website, mysteriousarizona.com.
Okay, I made a note. I'm going to try to get in touch with him. I'd love to talk more about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He'd be a great one to talk to because he's been working on this material for like 20 years. And he's made, you know, over 20 hikes down into the Grand Canyon. And, you know, he thinks he knows pretty close to where the area is, where the cavern is. But I think the cavern could have been sealed up by the Smithsonian.
Hmm. I'll be down.
Sealed away and just kind of all the artifacts were just shipped to Washington and never seen again, you know.
I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it, Gary. All right, look, let's take a little break here, okay?
Sure.
All right, we'll do it. We'll come back in just a few minutes here with Gary David. Gary can be found on the web at www.theorionzone.com, and you can link there from my site from here on out over there at MikeHagan.com. It is about, about 12:30 my time now on the 5th of June, 2007, and we'll play another song here from our friends, the Starlings. This one is called Gold Dust. Back in just a few minutes, it's Mike and listen to Radio Orbit. Thanks to Gary David for being here with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes to talk more about the Hopi and the stars above our heads.
Take that gold dust down off the shelf. Sprinkle gold dust on me. I'm a puppet now. Move my hands, yes, and move my head back and forth again.
Good stuff there from the Starlings. That's called Gold Dust. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. About 12:35, 12:33, 12:32, something like that. In the AM now, on the 5th day of June, 2007. Time just rolling right along. And we've got wonderful guests of ours with us from, what part of Arizona are you in, Gary?
I live in Chino Valley, Arizona, which is a little north of Prescott, Arizona, which is about 2 hours from Phoenix.
Okay.
North of Phoenix.
Yeah, we appreciate you sticking around with us here. It's sort of late in the nighttime there, 10:30 at night now, and I know you're a little bit under the weather, but we appreciate your time and all the stuff you're sharing with us. So
good to be here.
Okay, lots of stuff coming up, but before we go to some of these other questions, I'd like to ask you a question about the anthills. You mentioned before that in the third world, that the Hopi, I don't know if you call it their creation story or whatever, but they seem to believe that they have ancestors that came somehow from under the ground. Is this related to the anthill story?
The ant people, that's a group that's pretty interesting. It's a group in Hopi mythology that that is talked about. Let me talk about the idea of the different worlds so we get that.
Yes, please.
There are, like I said before, we're living at the end of the fourth world, according to the Hopi. The first world was the Hopi lived in, and it was also destroyed. It was destroyed by fire, which it could be an asteroid of some sort or volcanism, some sort of fire. Then the second world, it was destroyed by ice. It got very cold. You might think of the Ice Age or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the third world was destroyed by a great flood.
Wow, that's a common story, huh?
Yeah, it's a worldwide kind of thing. You know, I've even heard flood stories in South Dakota with the Lakota up there.
Wow.
But during the destruction of the first world and the second world, the Hopi were helped by the ant people. Now, apparently, during the destruction of the third world, they were kind of on their own because the ant people don't figure in that part of the timeline. But the destruction of these two worlds, apparently the ant people, they were kind of a benevolent race. They gave them refuge in caverns. They taught them how to sprout beans inside the caverns so they could survive these two cataclysms. And the Hopi have a bean dance or bean sprouting ceremony each February, and this kind of honors these ant people that helped them out during the destruction of these two worlds.
Wow. And they were supposed to be able to grow plants without sunlight or something like that?
Well, you can sprout beans in these caverns, and eventually you need sunlight.
Right, but okay, so they might not grow to fruition.
And, you know, the Hopi still do that today. It's part of their dietary triad of corn, beans, and squash.
Mm-hmm.
The bean, they get them started in these what are called kivas. A kiva is a prayer subterranean prayer chamber, and it's they get the fires going, and it's very hot in there, so it's a good place to sprout these beans. So the Hopi were helped by these ant people, you can see rock art picturing these. I've seen a strange rock art of these creatures with kind of large eyes and spindly bodies and bulbous heads, and some look like they have antenna and so forth.
Oh, weird.
But there are some of these in my book, these pictures, petroglyphs, that the ancient Hopi people carved on the rocks that show the ant people. And
Yeah, this one at Cottonwood Creek, this is the one that I'm looking at right now, is a pretty interesting image.
Well, that one, there are a lot of... that's by the town of Winslow, Arizona. Cottonwood Creek is a little bit strange because right next to Cottonwood Creek ruin, there's a Masonic worship site, which is kind of been destroyed right now. That site was developed in the 1930s. I got a hold of the Winslow Masonic Lodge, and one of the guys there said that it was constructed in the late 20s, early 30s. This this Masonic worship site, and there's a huge steel cross, and you can see pictures of that on my website. And right next to it is this rather small ruin site, but on the cliff faces. On top of this mesa, there are all these bizarre creatures, like the, you know, the ant creatures, and very strange petroglyphs in this area. So it's an odd mixture. You know, you wonder why the Masons would want to come out to this site and you know, to worship. And they put a lot of effort into building this. They put, you know, big concrete pillars, and you can still see these ruined pillars. And there was a big amphitheater there, and big worship site right on top of this mesa next to a Hopi ruin. So.
Very interesting. Mm. All right, what about the earthworks? You know, I had a friend of mine one time that said when he was in Hopi land, he said, yeah, they have like these pyramids there almost. He said, but it's almost like he was sort of referring to this whole ant reference. And he said, it's almost like the pyramids or the earthworks were built from the excavation that was being dug underneath. Like, in other words, like an ant sort of digs out, you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that would... Maybe you could just talk about whether these things even exist there, these big pyramids and this sort of thing.
Well, like I say, the Hopi weren't big pyramid builders like the Maya. But, you know, the Maya also have a tradition of ant people helping them.
Mm-hmm.
During the first creation or the first world, and the Maya were helped, and they were stone cities were built and roads were built. They had these real straight roads. They call them sacbés around Yucatan.
Uh-huh.
And apparently there are stories of these ant creatures being able to put stones into place by just whistling, you know.
Right. I mean, that's what Grandfather Wallace used to tell me.
Oh, yeah, really? Uh-huh.
Yep, he said that's how they built the pyramids. He said they had this little tool that was like a whistle, and they could levitate with it. And he said depending on the tone, they could cut stone with it. They could levitate with it. They could basically do anything with it. It was like this, and it was all done with sound. And he also said the way they did it was they built the pyramids from the top down.
Uh-huh.
Said it was the only way they could do it, and they levitated the thing until it was completed.
Well, I believe it. You know, like the Maya have the story of the ant people, and uh-huh. the Hopi, it saved them from two different cataclysms. So these are very strange people, and there's some correlation. I like to get into etymology and root words and stuff like that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit. I love language. I love
you know a lot of the listeners know about the Nephilim. You know,
sure.
From Sumerian mythology, Zechariah Sitchin and so forth.
Right, the fallen angels, sort of. They came and mated with the human ladies or whatever.
Right.
Right.
There's also a line of thinking that the word Nephilim is an Aramaic word. And it's those that means those that come from Orion, or those that are of Orion.
Huh.
So it doesn't have to be, you know, the giants in the earth so much. You know, they could be people from Orion, you know, creatures from Orion.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a kind of a coincidence, a linguistic coincidence, is the word Nemilim in Hebrew means ant. Kind of very, very similar to the Nephilim.
Nephilim. Huh.
Also, the word for Orion itself apparently comes from an Indo-European root word. That's M-O-R-U-I, Morui, and they drop the initial M, and you have that O-R-U-I, and that means ant. That word means ant. So apparently, you know, and if you look at the constellation Orion, it kind of has a slender waist, perhaps like an ant would have. The Hopi term for Orion is Hotamkam, which means beads on a string.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of looks like the three parts of an ant, the head, thorax, and abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of a bead-like ant parts, you know. So, One thing I find really interesting, though, this idea of what the Hopi word for ant is. The Hopi word for ant is Anu, and then the Hopi word for friend is Naki. So you have the Anunnaki, the ant friends, that help them through two different cataclysms. And, you see the Sumerian mythology and then this Hopi etymology corresponding. It's really amazing the way, the Anunnaki, the ant friend in Hopi.
Right, right.
And all this mythology about the ants helping, in both in Hopi country and in Maya country.
Huh, very interesting, yeah. I wonder... Well, I was going to ask you about the snakes, about the snake dance, mm-hmm. and the snake clan. There's the idea of the Hopi snake clan.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the snake come into the whole business?
Well, I've never been to a snake dance. They really don't like to have non-Indians attend the snake dance anymore. They're still held in August on the reservation. They used to have people go to the snake dance. It used to be kind of a tourist attraction. Famous, like D.H. Lawrence viewed a snake dance one time on the Hopi reservation.
Mm-hmm.
But the snake, the Hopi have a snake clan. And the snake, the Hopi have really a number of different clans, but one of these is the snake clan. And the way they came up with the rituals for this clan and the snake dance is there's a story about a culture hero named Teo. And Teo lived along the Colorado River. And he wondered where all this water was flowing. So he got in a log and just rode down the Colorado River and came to the ocean. And there's a story of Teal going across these what they call stepping stones or islands and going across the Pacific Ocean and going to an island where the snake people lived.
Mm-hmm.
And Teal witnessed a lot of rituals that the snake people were doing on this island. And he learned these rituals, and he eventually took one of the snake women as a bride and brought her back to Hopi land. And this is how the rituals for the snake dance were started from this migration to across the Pacific. And the snake people they encountered there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, back to Orion for a second. Why Orion? We have the relationship, perhaps an ant connection, but are there other reasons why Orion may have been chosen as something that they were trying to mirror on the ground, as opposed to other particular constellations?
Well, I think, for one thing, Orion is the most important constellation for the Hopi. Orion synchronizes some of their sacred ceremonies. I mentioned the kiva, or an underground prayer chamber.
Uh-huh.
The way you get into these kivas is through a ladder, through a hatchway on the top.
Okay.
And you climb down a ladder, and you go into this subterranean place, and that's where all the ceremonies are held. But one ceremony in particular, the winter solstice ceremony, is the way it starts is they see Orion come into the view of the hatchway, and that means that the ceremony should begin in December. So Orion is very important, probably the most important constellation for the Hopi.
And so, yeah, so it makes sense that they would... Again, this whole idea of above, so, as above, so below, is something that we see, again, in lots of different cultures and historical traditions around the world. And it's, this whole idea of archaeoastronomy is becoming more and more amazing, actually. I mean, it seems that these things that you're uncovering and bringing to light are being found in many, many places.
There's been a lot of work done. There's a good website called the Solstice Project. It's all about Chaco Canyon. And a while ago, a few years ago, Robert Redford did a documentary on Chaco Canyon and the archaeoastronomy they were doing there at Chaco Canyon. It's just amazing the way a lot of these buildings are lined up to say the rise of the summer solstice or the winter solstice sunrise. A lot of the buildings are aligned to these very important places on the horizon.
Well, I sort of hesitate about this, but a number of people are asking about 2012. We're talking about solstices. Is there any connection? Are you involved or interested in this whole 2012 business that so many people are talking about?
Well, I think it's a fascinating kind of concept, but in terms of the Hopi, they say that we're in the end times, but they're not quite as specific as the Maya.
Uh-huh.
In terms, you know, the Maya were the masters of time.
Oh yeah,
they were obsessed with calendars and keeping precise dates, and every day had a certain character.
Their calendars are just beautiful,
actually. And you know, they go thousands of years into the past, mm-hmm. and they're very precise with time. On the other hand, I think the Hopi are more or less the keepers of space. They do.
How so? What do you mean by that?
Well, they're doing ceremonies on the Hopi Reservation, and their ceremony, it's a cycle that they go through throughout the year. They do different ceremonies, and they're basically keeping the world in balance. When the world gets out of balance, that means that they're not doing the ceremonies quite correctly, or they're not doing them as much as they used to.
Mm.
So the world is kind of being thrown out of balance because the Hopi are, because of the pressures of modern life, they're unable to do the ceremonies the way they used to. So, I don't think that the Hopi are quite as specific in terms of mm-hmm. Dates as the Maya are.
Right. But as far as a general sense of things, they feel a great change on the horizon.
Oh, definitely. The Hopi have a big prophetic tradition in their culture. The Hopi foretold the existence of they call them horseless carts on black ribbons would come to pass.
Yeah, meaning the railroads, obviously.
Meaning, cars going on black asphalt.
Oh, okay.
And they talked about spider webs going across the land. This is a way of looking at telegraph lines and, telephone and electric lines.
Right.
They had the idea that men will someday live in space, and this is happening now, of course, with the International Space Station and so forth. They also talked about what they call the gourd of ashes, the gourd of ashes will fall on the earth and cause great destruction.
Hmm.
And this happened before Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Hopi were predicting these kinds of things, and all these things are coming to pass. The Hopi said that they would go to what they called the House of Micah. The House of Micah four times, and knock on the door of the House of Micah to talk about peace, and each time they'll be turned away. Well, this has happened.
The UN.
The UN building, I believe, in even Grandfather Martin
mm-hmm.
has gone to the.
He's told me the story. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he always talked about volcanoes. That's what Grandfather Martin. It scared the hell out of me when he talked about it, but he would be interpreted by his. I think it was his nephew or something, a guy named Emery.
Oh, yeah.
But at any rate, he talked a lot about I think he was referring to exactly what you're talking about, Gary, that when the ceremonies aren't done correctly, and it's not just the Hopi, he talked about it because he would do these gatherings and talk at these gatherings with Lakota and other people, but anyway, the whole idea was, that when the ceremony wasn't able to be completed correctly or whatever, things would get out of whack, out of balance.
Well, I think this is symptomatic of the age, and of course, a lot of the the tribes are being decimated by alcoholism and poverty. You go to Pine Ridge, and it's one of the poorest places in the country. You know.
I know. I can tell you, I was there in February. It just broke my heart. You know.
Yeah. And the ceremonies are not being done with the same purity and the same depth that they had been before. And I think this is kind of symptomatic of the end times. And you put this together with all the floods and famine and tsunamis and earthquakes and volcanoes that go around the earth. You know, the climate, global climate change, and so forth. I think these are all symptoms of the final days of the end times.
Well, do you take a couple things? The Kachina, the star. I know there's a, and maybe you could clarify this whole idea, but I know that there was an idea of the Kachina as a star that would maybe appear in the heavens at a particular time that would signify the changes or the oncoming or something.
Well, there's actually a Hopi Kachina named the Star Kachina.
The Star Kachina.
And it's called the Sohu Kachina, and there's a picture of the Sohu Kachina on my website. And you can look at it, and you can see that there are three stars across the crest of the mask of this particular Kachina. And this might represent the three belt stars of Orion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to note that the word Sohu means star in Hopi, and in Egyptian, the word Sahu means the stars of Orion.
Hmm.
So you get a Hopi Egyptian connection going on.
And you found a Maya connection too. So there's sort of
a Maya connection. There's a chapter in my book that talks about the Maya connection. There are a lot of different, there was a big trade network into the Mesoamerica.
Yeah, so much of this stuff points to a sort of global culture almost, you know, that was trading and communicating and probably traveling over the oceans
and
all kinds of things.
This is one of the things that the Smithsonian Institute wanted to hush up, because they're totally against the idea of diffusionism. They have the idea of isolationism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, before 1492, there were no Caucasians or anything on this continent, which, you know, seems ridiculous to me, but
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the paradigm that the archaeologists use, and the hushing up of the Kincaid story of the lost city in the Grand Canyon is just one example of this.
Very interesting. Yeah. All right. Let me ask you a question about. We're going to take a break here in just a couple minutes, but there. I've always been interested in the Pawnee as well, and you wrote a paper or an article about a connection between the Hopi and the Pawnee. Can you just talk about it just for my own benefit for a couple minutes about that?
Well, I really can't, because it's part of the book that I didn't have room for. You know, I saw all these connections because the Pawnee lived in Nebraska, and they're very in tune with the stars, and they had star charts on rawhide.
On hides, yeah.
And, I noted a lot of, you can go to an article on my website, I think it's called the Pawnee Hopi Connection, and a lot of the words, I can't remember exactly what they are now, because it's been a long time since I reviewed that material, but a lot of the words are in Pawnee are the same in Hopi. So I think, the Pawnee came or at least lived in the Southwest and perhaps interacted with the ancient Hopi before moving up to the Nebraska area.
Okay.
So there was some interaction, a lot more interaction than, archaeologists will have you believe. Because, like I said at the beginning of the program, the Serpent Mound, supposedly in Ohio, was built, by the Snake Clan of the Hopi. So, the Hopi were getting around the continent in much greater degree than traditional archaeologists will have you believe.
Well, you know something else that I wanted to ask you that we got a couple minutes before the top of the hour here, but I've recognized this amazing resemblance between Tibetan people and the Hopi people. And have you ever read or heard anything about this? The fact that they're sort of like on the exact opposite sides of the Earth?
They're on the exact opposite sides of the globe, and they have many elements that are similar. They have like a four directions, and the Lakota Sioux are the same way. They have a color for each direction.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
And you see these Tibetan mandalas that have a color in each direction.
Yeah.
And you see Navajo sand paintings.
Right, and then the medicine wheel and
colors.
All that.
So, you know, I think Tibetans may have come over here.
I mean, they actually resemble each other physically.
Physically, they're very much alike. You know, the Hopi are kind of stocky and rather short people, and they look kind of Tibetan to me, too.
Yeah, facial characteristics. Yeah, I really found that. All right, look, let's take a little break, okay?
Sure.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. My guest tonight is Gary David. You can find information about Gary and the very interesting work that he's doing on the web at www.theorionzone.com. And you can link there directly from my site at mikehagan.com from here on out. We'll have this show up in the archives in the next 24 or so. And in the meantime, let's hear a little bit of music from my new friends, the Starlings. Wonderful band from Seattle, and had a nice opportunity to see them play their music on Friday night, and I appreciate what they're doing and sharing it with you and me and everybody else tonight. So here we go. This is the Starlings, and the song is called Take Me to the Fire. The song, the CD is called Songbook, and you can find information about the band on the web at starlingsmusic.com.
Down the road like they know me. I am a
Take Me to the Fire. That's the Starlings. You're listening to Mike Hagan on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Gary David, author of The Orion Zone. And you can find information about Gary at the website of the same name. And we'll get right back to him here. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Mike. I wonder if I could give out the number where you can get The Orion Zone.
Sure.
It's published by Adventures Unlimited Press. You can go to adventuresunlimitedpress.com and order it there, or you could order it at my website, theorionzone.com. Let me give out a toll-free number in case you want to order the book and you don't have a computer.
Go ahead, 800?
Well, the number is 815.
Oh, that's in Illinois.
253-6390. I believe that's a toll-free number. Maybe I'm mistaken on that, but I believe that's it.
Okay, 815-253-6390.
That's right, and that's Adventures Unlimited Press. The publisher is David Childress.
Yeah, David Hatcher Childress, sure.
Yeah, he also is an author and globetrotter. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, done some great work, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, let's see. Questions coming up on the website. I'm going to try to get to a few of the questions from listeners, okay?
Okay.
This one has been sort of up here for a bit. Mike, can you ask Gary if he's seen the movie The Fountain? Because in the movie it has the same Orion star pattern. I wondered if you thought anything about that.
No, I haven't seen that movie. Who's in it?
I'm not sure. I haven't either. Speaking of movies, have you ever seen this one called Koyaanisqatsi? It's a Hopi word,
you
actually.
Know, it's hard to get movies in my part of the country. I live in a rural area, and it's... You know, I've heard about it. I've heard it's an excellent documentary.
Yeah, and that's one that I have seen, and it was remarkable.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And there's not a word spoken in it.
Uh-huh, yeah. I've heard a lot about it, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, okay. Maybe you could talk a little bit in general about paradigms and this idea of the changing of ages and old paradigms falling and new worlds and this sort of thing. The evidence does seem to be coming in from many, many different ancient cultures and indigenous people. From your experience, what do you make of it? I mean,
a lot of cultures have these different ages. You know, the Hindus in India have this the idea of the yugas, and the Mayas have the period, the ages, and you know, the Aztecs, and they also seem to have this cyclical view of existence. I'd like to really focus on something that we haven't talked about, and it's really crucial to the book.
Mm-hmm.
And this deals with a figure that is really primary in this particular age, the fourth age, and it's the god Masau.
Masau, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the god Masau is the Hopi god of death, the underworld, and the earth. And Masau is a nocturnal god. His counterpart might be Osiris
yeah.
Egypt.
And again, that's related to Orion.
And yeah, Osiris was Orion, the stars. And I think Masau could be a similar figure. It's maybe the terrestrial version of Orion for the Hopi. Let me describe Masau physically, because he's kind of a frightening sort of person or figure. The Masau has a mask which has very large round eyes, and there's a round mouth, and Masau has a kind of a huge bald head, and the head is shaped like a summer squash, and it has kind of the texture of a summer squash.
Mm-hmm.
And the forehead bulges out in a ridge. The feet are very long. The forearms are very long. The body is kind of spindly, and the body is gray.
Hmm.
In fact, the root word of Masau is mas, M-A-S, and that's the Hopi word for gray.
Hmm.
So this description that the Hopi give from legends and myths, there's a picture of an artist's rendition of Masau in my book. And it looks very much like an extraterrestrial gray. It's a real spooky kind of figure.
Mm-hmm.
It's the figure is kind of a taboo figure in Hopi circles. In fact, I took a class from a Hopi woman a few years ago, and I asked about the god Masao, and she would not talk about the god Masao at all.
Wow, interesting.
You know, it was such a kind of a taboo almost that she didn't want to discuss anything about Masao. But, you know, I think Masao is kind of the key to this whole Orion correlation in Arizona. Masao is said to travel the entire Earth before morning comes, so that
mm-hmm.
might be the,
yeah, that could be the
way the constellation goes from east to west across the sky.
Mm-hmm.
The Orion can be seen as kind of a rectangular constellation if you have a big rectangle in the sky. And there are pictures of Masao, petroglyphs of Masao, that I've seen, and there are the Masao has kind of a rectangular body in some of them.
This one, again, in fact, there's one on your Anthills page, believe it or not, that I see that looks, the one that sort of looks like Cocopelli.
Yeah.
That actually looks like the Orion constellation to me.
Well, there are a lot of, you know, rock art is really interesting to see in this area, and there's so much of it. I've been focusing on the kind of the Winslow area. There's a lot of rock art there in that particular area. And I found the star map, which has all the major constellations of the winter hexagon on this map.
Man.
And it's just an amazing thing, right? A few miles from Winslow, you know, standing on the corner of Winslow, Arizona, you know.
Amazing, yeah. Well, such a fine sight to see. Right? Let's see. All right, well, what else would you like to talk about? I've got plenty of questions here, but...
If somebody has any questions, I can try to deal with them.
Well, a listener here has a question about an article they read that you wrote for Fate magazine talking about flying machines.
Well, yeah, the flying shields... in Hopi, they call these Pa'atu Bota, the flying shields. And there's a picture of a petroglyph, which I think is a flying shield. In fact, it looks like a triangular flying shield, kind of like the one that flew over Phoenix about 10 years ago.
Oh, man.
But the Hopi have these traditions of flying shields and of kachinas piloting these shields. And the word Patu Bota, pa, means water, okay? It can mean water, can mean concentric rings in water, so this might be a way to describe the way that these shields looked in the air, kind of like concentric rings going through the air. Like I said, there are a lot of myths dealing with kachinas coming and even taking Hopi women for wives, so there's mating between Hopi women and these kachinas that come on these flying shields. So,
Man, again, it's reminiscent of the whole Nephilim story and all that.
Exactly.
And then you have the Hindu thing. I remember the story of the Vimana. They talk about these wild spaceships or something that they fought big wars with and stuff that would blow the bejesus out of everything, like nuclear weapons almost or something.
Well, you know, the Hopis say that, you know, in the third world, the previous world, they had a lot of machines and contraptions that we don't even have in this world. So, you know, they were far advanced, and I don't doubt that there were flying machines back then.
Huh.
And, you know, there's rock art all over the Southwest picturing these things.
Right.
And there are myths. There's one particular myth that I like about there was a great flood. Okay, and the great flood was going to engulf this one village, and everybody was in chaos, and everybody fled kind of out of this village to get out of the way of the flood, and these two children, they were young children, they were twins, and they were kind of left behind. And they started off in search of their parents, and they camped the first night on the way trying to find the parents, and they saw this creature come down in a flying shield. And in the story, it's called the Sky God, Sotuknong. is the what they called him. And this sky god was described as having a kind of a clothing that looked like icicles. So, it shimmered like icicles. So, you know, for a non-technological society, to try to describe metallic sort of clothing, this would be one way they would do this. And supposedly this god took these two children up into this flying shield, and they were far up above the land, and they were looking down, and it was a very benevolent being. This being gave the children melons to eat and corn, and he said that he would come again in their dreams to instruct them on the proper way to live. So he flew them towards where the parents were, and he put them down right at the edge of the place where the parents were, and let them be rejoined with the parents. So this is one of the stories of a flying shield that is in the Hopi tradition.
Amazing. Okay, what does Gary think of the techniques of the shaman or shamanism in general?
Shamanism was an ancient way of dealing with the world. Shamanism goes into Siberia. The roots are in Siberia, and in Tibet there's a lot of vestiges of shamanism, and it made it in many forms in this country. You know, Lakota Sioux are very adept in shamanism, and the Hopi are, and the Maya, and it's just so pervasive on this continent as well as in Siberia. So.
All right, let's see. What else do we have here to ask you? Well, you're not too far from Phoenix. Could you talk a little bit about the word Phoenix and the Masonic relationship, perhaps?
That's kind of a thing that I've been trying to deal with more recently. I have a little bit about Phoenix in my book. Phoenix is a site of a different culture, called the Hohokam. They were a great culture. They built something like 500 miles of canals and aqueducts in the Phoenix Basin.
Huh.
And this was they started there around 300 BC, so they were even a little bit before the Hopis did the major settlements on the mesas. They were building settlements in the Phoenix area. And the city of Phoenix was named, of course, after that bird that arises from its own ashes. It's reborn from its own ashes.
And again, another metaphor for the changing of worlds and all that.
Oh,
perhaps,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And there was this the person who named it. His name was Daryl Dupa. He's a really interesting character. He knew. He was kind of one of these frontier characters that came to Arizona in the 1860s. He was shipwrecked off the coast of South America. He did prospecting in the Bradshaw Mountains in Arizona. He was really checking up on his uncle's claims that he had in Arizona here. But this guy was really erudite. He was classically trained. He knew French and Spanish and Latin and Greek, and he could quote Shakespeare, long passages of Shakespeare, especially if he was lubricated by a little whiskey.
Right.
But this guy was the one that named Phoenix, this bird that reinvents itself. The Phoenix, of course, is also called the Bennu bird in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole cult of the Phoenix in Heliopolis, close to Giza.
Hmm.
And they had the Ben stone on top of the obelisk, and it was supposed to represent the Phoenix, rising from the ashes, being reborn.
Mm-hmm.
But in the American Southwest, it's basically called Aztlan. It's been called Aztlan. And this is called Place of the Heron. The heron is kind of a naturalistic model for the phoenix. And in fact, the first lodge in Arizona was called the Aztlan Lodge.
Yeah.
And
there's a movement, isn't there? A movement to try to change parts of California, New Mexico, and Arizona back to Mexican territory and call it Aztlan again.
Yeah, that's a Chicano movement that Mexican territory originally,
mm-hmm,
and they say that Aztlan is all part of that that area, the region where the tribes came from. The Aztecs came down from this area and moved into Mexico and Mexico City.
Right.
But this guy Daryl Dupa, he was one of the Freemasons that began Phoenix, and a lot of the original founding fathers of Phoenix, they were all Masons.
Mm-hmm.
The Goldwater family, Barry Goldwater was
sure.
A Mason,
right.
And his grandfather was one of the founding fathers of Phoenix. And there's a lot of Masonic influence in Phoenix, Arizona. And Phoenix is located on the 33rd parallel, which is a primary number in Freemasonry.
Right.
It's also an interesting to note that the first governor of Arizona, George Hunt, was buried. You can go to his grave. He was buried in a Egyptian style pyramid.
Huh.
In Phoenix.
You got a picture of that up, I think.
Yeah, there's a picture of it on my site.
Right.
It's at the bottom of the homepage there. You can see his grave. And he was also a Freemason. So there are a lot of Freemasonry influences in Phoenix. And that's some of the things that I'm going to track down perhaps in my next book.
Mm-hmm. A question came up about the Navajo. Is there, maybe you could talk about conflict in general. What are the Hopi people facing in terms of, their neighbors and their relationship to, the U.S. government and the other Native nations?
Well, if you go to any reservation, there's always a complex interaction between the tribal council and the spiritual elders. And it's made even more complicated because the Hopi reservation is completely surrounded by the Navajo reservation. And the Navajo were thought to have come down from the north in about 1500 and settled in the area. And there's always been kind of an antipathy between the two tribes. And sometimes the two members of the tribes intermarry, but there's always been kind of an uneasy feeling between the Hopi and the Navajo.
Hmm. To this day.
To this day, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
There are land disputes, and because the Hopi are kind of surrounded, and the reservation is very small compared to the Navajo, which stretches into New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. What's the biggest threat, you think, to the Hopi people?
I think it's just modern life, and you can go up to the reservation now, and some of the villages don't have electricity. Others are electrified, sometimes you see solar panels on old stone houses. It's kind of an odd mixture. The Hopi are struggling just like the rest of us to make sense of this chaotic age we're living in.
Right.
And like I said, a lot of the ceremonies are being curtailed or abbreviated or not done properly, and a lot of the ancient knowledge is being lost. And I really hope, it's my hope, that a Hopi person will come forth and really codify this information in a written form. I've done what I could, but I'm an outsider. I'm a Pahana. I'm a white person, so I don't have access to the sacred knowledge. But unless some Hopi does this, I think that the Hopi ceremonies will be lost ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't have this written link, I know it's the oral tradition is very strong among a lot of tribes,
right.
And this is what they've existed and survived with the oral tradition for for thousands of years. But I think, you know, there's such an onslaught of modern life and materialism and, you know, getting the TVs and cars and things like that. And the whole drug problem on the reservation is getting very bad. There's crystal meth on the Navajo and Hopi reservations. And, of course, there's always alcoholism that decimates the people. So there are a lot of threats that the Native people are facing. And I just hope that some of this information can be saved in some form or other. And I just wish some Hopi, knowledgeable Hopi, would step up and do it, because, you know, I can't do it myself because I don't have the authority to do it.
What, if people want to get involved or anything, you have any advice for people who are interested and they want to try to do something to help?
Well, I would come out to the place, and, you know, you can help in a lot of different ways. If you're young and strong, you can, you know, help the elders cut firewood, and because there's, you know, I mean, it gets really cold in the middle.
Oh yeah, and the desert in the middle of the winter, yeah.
But, you know, there are a lot of things that people can do just to come out and experience the Hopi culture and the way of life. And you can find things to do, a lot of things to do, just to help the people on a day-to-day basis to weather this chaotic time we're going through.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, Gary, I know you're sort of running out of fuel here, and with good reason. So why don't we give out the website and the phone numbers a couple more times, and you can sort of finish off with a couple final words if you'd like, and we'll move along.
Okay. The website is theorionzone.com. You can find out a lot of information there. You can order the book from adventuresunlimitedpress.com. And again, the number is 815-253-6390. You can order the book that way.
Okay.
So it's just my hope that the end times will not be too soon. It seems like everything, all the indications are that the end times are right upon us at any time, but.
But the end times also significant are significant of a new something else afterward as well, though, right?
But hopefully, yeah. The Hopi have kind of a philosophical view of this, that, you know, we've gone through three destructions before, we can go through another one.
Uh-huh.
And they say that, you know, when the fifth world finally does come, it will be a much better world, and people will be more spiritually attuned, and be we won't have the corruption that seems to be besieging us right here, right now.
Right. Well, I sort of have to agree, and I sure hope for it. So, anyway, all right. Well, Gary, you've been wonderful. Thanks so much for your work.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. And there are a couple of things I'd like to talk to you about off the air. I'll send you a note sometime in the next few days, okay?
Okay, great.
All right, take care of yourself again, and I'll mention the website and the phone number before I get off the air here, okay?
Great.
All right, take care. All right, everybody, there it was, Gary David, doing some interesting work with regard to the Hopi and, well, lots of things that that they're involved with, but primarily this relationship with the stars and the relationship to the rest of the world, frankly. So, anyway, thanks very much to Gary David, and we'll talk with Gary again, hopefully, one day. Okay, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And I think we'll play a couple songs here. I got a couple short ones here from the Starlings. And then we can come back. I got some news stories to talk about if we'd like. And I can take some phone calls if you guys would like. And I can hop on the chat room as well. And we can talk a little bit about what's going on in there if you like. So anyway, we've got a few minutes to figure things out. So take five and come on back. Stick around with me if you can. We got another half hour for the program here, and we'll take some phone calls. The number is 573-443-8255, or you can send me a note via email at orbitradio@aol.com, and you can also hop in the chat room, and you can do that directly from my front page. Just go over there to mikehagan.com and then just slide down and click on the live chat link. All right? Okay, in the meantime, this is a song called The Working Man Blues. How about it? It's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, The Starlings. This is from a CD called Songbook.
How long, how long, stacking?
All right, that's called Traveling, and before that we heard, what was it, the Working Man Blues. It's a band called the Starlings. Good music coming out of Seattle, Washington. And it's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Pleasure to be with all of you tonight, and I think I'll pop in the chat room here and say hello. Is it getting hot down there in Missouri? Believe it or not, Ian, it hasn't. It's been real cool. It's been a strange spring and early summer. You know, it got really warm in March to the point where it was devastating to some of the farmers, because anybody who grew crops that were flowering, fruit plants and that sort of thing, cherries and peaches or whatever, all that stuff flowered very early. And then maybe the second week of April, it froze, man, hardcore, for like 10, 11, 12 degrees for 3 or 4 nights in a row, and just finished off any of that stuff. And then it got warm, relatively warm again, and then it rained so hard that it washed everything away. We had huge floods. I live in a place called Rocheport, which is, as the crow flies, only about a mile and a half from the Missouri River. And luckily we're up on a hill, but man, the Missouri River flooded pretty significantly this year. And I drive around there all the time, and it's still pretty high, but the peak was probably, 2 weeks ago now or so, maybe a little bit longer. But boy, oh boy, it was really pretty wild there for a while. But now it's been cool, almost fall-like, but sunny and pretty nice. I mean, now things are growing pretty good, and, who knows. But I have a feeling that the summer is going to be really nice. I'm actually feeling really that we made it through the sort of rough stuff, and that now we're going to get a real nice summer like we deserve after a difficult winter. So, anyway, let's see. The phone number here, 573-443-8255. Give me a call if you'd like to talk and chat, got any questions or concerns or anything like that. Love to have a chance to talk to y'all. And if not, I'll go look at the news and see what's happening. Would I make any notes here about anything? This movie, Koyaanisqatsi, I should mention that again. And I'll thank Gary David one more time for his time earlier in the program. Koyaanisqatsi, it's a documentary. I should I'm gonna throw it in my search engine real fast here, and then see if I can remember what the word means. It's Hopi for something. It's a film. It was made by a guy named Reggio, Godfrey Reggio. And I think it means life out of balance. Maybe that's what it is. Let me go to the... Okay, here you go. Wikipedia. This will have it for me, right? It's supposed to. Koyaanisqatsi. Life out of balance. Yeah. So, it's a film. It's actually quite old. It's like 25 years old. It was made in 1982. And it's mostly this slow motion and time-lapse photography from above, for the most part. And you get to see some very interesting imagery that goes along with this wonderful musical composition. And in the Hopi language, and this is just what Wiki is telling us, but I know it's close because I've heard it before, they say Koyaanisqatsi means life of moral corruption and turmoil, life out of balance. And the film sort of implies that modern humanity is living in this manner, in such a manner. And it's very reminiscent of what Gary has been talking to us about for the last hour and a half, you know, that the Hopi and their own situation is representative of the whole ball of wax. And, you know, we're seeing this come from lots of different cultures and communities and belief systems right now, you know, that things are at you know, a crux, a, what do they call it? A tipping point. It's my own impression as well. Although I see a wonderful future ahead of us. If, you know, if you know what it takes to make it through the gate, that's basically what's going on, in my opinion. And I don't think it's particularly sentimental. I think that evolution is hard at work, and whatever's coming, you know, there are those who will be able to pass the tests, and there are those who will probably not be able to. I mean, that's always the way it works, you know. Evolution is essentially an intelligence test. And, you know, only so many pass the bar. It's the way the world works. It's just that it tends to work in more of a step pattern than a slow, comfortable curve. So that you get these long periods of time where things sort of stay the same and people forget. They forget about evolution. They talk about it in their universities, but they don't think that it's actually happening, you know, in current events and in their own species, you know, in individual people, individual, you know, units. That's what they like to call us, you know, in their scientific terminology. But, you know, evolution happens on an individual level. It happens to individuals within a particular genotype. And evolution is always happening. And the interesting thing about evolution is that the way it works, you know, mutations occur. And you can argue which way or that way the, you know, from which way the evolutionary mutation or mutagenic factor came from. You know, was it cosmic radiation, or was it, you know, earthly radiation, or was it, you know, a change in diet? Anything that might cause, you know, a genetic mutation, those things are happening all the time. But a mutation doesn't take hold or, let me rephrase it like this. There may be a gene, right, that exists in an individual that is a result of a mutagen, a mutation. And that gene, in any particular environment, the current environment, for example, might be of no great consequence. You know, its expression just isn't, it doesn't mean anything. It's not effective in the environment. But when the environment shifts, well, then a gene that had little or no consequence in the previous environment can have enormous consequence. And so you never really know, you know, the mutagens and the mutations that are floating around within the population. It's not like, you know, typically it's not like a mutation occurs and then the mutation just automatically takes over in the existing environment. That's not the way it works. It's that the mutations are subtle and being thrown out all the time. But when an environment shifts, all of a sudden, people who, or individuals within a population who carry a specific gene can then, you know, move forward their own evolutionary strategy, and you get what they call a bifurcation. You know, there have been bifurcations in the human past. All right, we've got a call here. I think I'll just say hello and shut my own mouth for a second. Good evening. Welcome to Radio Orbit. Who's this?
This is Deborah.
Hey, Deborah.
I just had a little bit to say as far as some connections. Like, my mother lived in Prescott, and I've been to the Hohokam, where they have the museums and the archaeological site.
Uh-huh.
And
do me a favor, speak up just a little bit louder in your phone, okay?
I was afraid there might be an echo. Like,
well, I know you have a soft voice, but I have to be able to let the listeners hear you.
So there's no echo on the radio?
Nope, you sound great, as long as your radio's not on too loud.
It's in the other room.
All right, you just,
okay.
Okay, you're fine.
So the Hohokam are sophisticated land engineers, irrigation and stuff, so I've seen that. And also the connection that he brought up, the Kachinas. And do you remember me asking Star about the dream that I had? Last year, it's a year and a half ago.
Refresh my memory. What was it about?
It was kind of like a prophetic dream, because then I saw it on television coming out of a really strange serial television program.
It had to do with a frog?
Blue electricity that came out of the mouth.
Yeah. I do remember. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I did look up some stuff on this, like a blue gachina. It has to do with prophecy, among other things. So I learned some more about it. Just, it was really hard to find anything at all. But also, then when you were talking about the Pawnees, I would like to know more about the Pawnees also. Because remember, I shared that Pawnee Rock scary nightmare dream with you.
Yep,
I
did.
It happened when I was camping out there. So I just thought, wow. And that Kachina thing, when he was talking about it looking kind of rectangular, that was in my dream when it came to my door.
Huh.
And it had the big round, I thought it was like an eye or something, kind of like it was camouflage, and it had these antenna or some kind of something sticking out on the sides of the head. And much later I found those petroglyph pictures.
That look a lot like
you're talking
that.
About,
yeah.
And it's rectangular, yeah.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So Masau, is, how's it spelled?
It's M-A-S-S-A-U, but I've, that's the way it's spelled in Gary's book, but I've actually seen it spelled M-A-S-S-A-W, and it's interesting because if you spell it M-A-S-S-A-W, then you can put it in a mirror, and it spells the same thing upside down and backwards.
Ah, very interesting. Yeah.
So, I don't know, but it's... The Hopi tradition is another one of these that is profound to me, and I spent just a little bit of time with this elder, Grandfather Martin, that I mentioned toward the beginning of the program, and he really, you know, he really had an impact on me, and I this whole situation with the native peoples is just you know, a very, very difficult thing that's going on. I mean, it's not just the Hopi, it's not just the Lakota, it's indigenous people all over the planet that are just under genocidal siege. I mean, they have been for, you know, for a couple thousand years, essentially, but, man, it is just, it's just so blatant anymore, you know, it's horrible to see it.
That must be what my blood is resonating with, all of this, and you and I both have Native American blood.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about the DNA when I was trying to call, and I was told by the dentist that there's only like 10% of the people that have structures inside their mouth like I do. I just thought, wow,
yeah.
That sounds like remnants of something old.
Yeah,
I always
yeah.
wondered if it had to do with extra intuitive abilities or some sort of sensory apparatus. I don't know, but I have these funny things that nobody else has.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, but something, I don't know, like everybody else, I mean, I'm just curious and wondering and just sort of hanging on to see what comes next, but certainly, as far as the sustainability of, you know, the current situation, I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine things going on a whole lot longer without something changing. What's your general sense of what's happening in the world, or are you even interested in talking about it?
It is very difficult for me to talk about. I have withdrawn more and more.
Mm-hmm. What about the local scene here?
I find happiness when I'm in nature.
Me
I'm
too.
I'm working
too,
outside all the time. That
you
going
to come to my party in June? You know, we're outside
in
the woods.
I may do that. It depends on how I feel. But yes, I'm open to thinking about that.
Okay.
I'll have to get in touch with you and find out how to get there.
Sure. Now, what do you think about what's happening in the local scene? I know you have a lot of communication with younger people and stuff? I mean, what do you see happening around here?
There's a lot of depression that is, they're trying to be creative, I think, to mask some of their confusion, and particularly after the murder in West Virginia and Joe and the situation that he was in and the things he was feeling. I'll be blunt and I can say, yeah, I understand some of the younger generation that's coming out of the computer machine mind.
Mm-hmm.
They're disconnected so badly from something, and when they get drunk and they have their frat parties and they show up at some of the bars here where they've just gone into this binge drinking thing, they turn into little monsters, and I've stopped going there because I've been injured so often by them.
Mm.
And I can see that side of an empty spirit that is, or some demonic of some sort that's unleashed, and I think that's what this Joe was feeling so intensely. And I have been in that space myself, and this really troubles me about. It's just the generation in the past 3 or 4 years that I am seeing out here that adults and parents do not see. And it's very troubling. So, yeah, there are pockets of kids that, like the hip-hop crowd, that, you know, they're trying to get creative consciousness as far as their rap styles. But I have pretty much dropped out of going to a lot of these places lately, and it's tied with this terrible grief. Planetary grief about something that has taken over much of the soul, and it's so many ugly things coming through the young people as well as through the political, you know, the elders and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All this junk with the war. Something is happening, and it's tearing our fabrics, the intergenerational fabric. It's tearing it apart. I feel it, and it's weighing heavy on me all the time. And the only time I get away from it mostly is when I'm out in nature and I go on my bike, or I'm out like you are working on my land.
Right.
And it takes my mind off of all of that. So I'm really deeply troubled by things. It kind of affects my health. Allergens and things that have never been out there before. Things that I feel like poison in my food, the toxins that have made me so ill with my digestive trouble, and then finding out it's in the peanut butter I had. Those things really upset me too, besides the pesticide that was used on me. So
I know, the whole world is full of
tearing the trees down around my house, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, you know, like Heraclitus always said, you know, all flows and nothing lasts forever. So I have... I feel a lot of the same things that you do, and at the same time, I feel that that we are on the cusp of something. I've always loved the alchemical, you know, intuition that, you know, the negredo, the darkest, you know, before the dawn, and I have to think that we're getting very, very close to the darkest hour.
Well, what troubles me is I have the prophetic dreams, and if I write things down and they come true, that's what, you know, that's scary. Mm. That is terrifying.
Stop writing them down.
Well, and I told you, you think that...
I'm kidding.
And to blame the messenger.
No, I'm just kidding you.
I mean, like I told you, I had that dream about the college.
Yeah.
And then about the Latino, the L.A.
Well, hear about this. How about you have
parade.
How about you have a dream? How about you have a dream about all the scumbag liars and cheaters and rapists and murderers and deceivers and manipulators, that they all get shown up for what they are? How about that? That's going to be my last word. That way, see, I have to end on a happy note, Deborah. All right? That's our dream
that
for tonight. That's our
there.
Dream for tonight. That's our dream for tonight, okay?
I do. That's what I write, the good things. I remove myself from whatever this paradigm is, and I write and think about, I dream about something better.
All right.
I know there's something else out there.
It's happening. I love
and
you. I got to go.
The gate's open good.
All right.
Okay.
Take care of yourself.
Bye.
Thank you for calling, as always. All right, everybody. Thank you, Deborah. And let's see, a couple minutes left. What time is it? Yeah. Got a couple minutes. If anybody else wants to call, get on the horn, 573-443-8255. Glad to chat with you for a minute. Take a look in the chat room here for a second. Mike, how did you hook up with Grandfather Martin? Grandfather Martin was at an elders gathering that I was privileged to be invited to in 2002 in Denver, Colorado, and he spoke with a number of different elders from different tribes. I was there because of my grandfather Wallace and grandfather CeeLo Black Crow. Those two were the reason, primary reason why I was there. And you know, Kent Stedman was there with me. Kent Stedman and his partner Wendy came out and stayed with me for a few days, and we spent I think 3 days basically camping out with the grandfathers, and it was quite an experience. But Grandfather Martin was amazing. I have a whole load of notes from when he spoke, and he only spoke in the Hopi language, and he had his nephew whose name is Emery, and Emery translated for Grandfather Martin. But he had a profound message, actually. He talked a lot about, you know, the earth being in a state of imbalance, like we've been talking about tonight, and that if it continued, that there would be very difficult times. And he meant it in a cataclysmic sense. Like I mentioned earlier, he was talking about the volcanoes and all this sort of thing, and that that would eventually occur unless we got back to some sort of a new equilibrium. But he said something that always blew me away, and I've never forgotten, and it was very similar to what Terence taught. Terence taught it in a way that was a little bit different than Grandfather Martin, a little bit more wordy, as you can imagine. You know, Terence liked to use the butterfly effect as his metaphor for what Grandfather Martin told me. But the butterfly effect, as you all know, because I talk about it so much, is the idea that very, very small perturbations in big, gigantic systems can bring about unexpected, improbable, and absolute remarkable change. And that change can sometimes move things to a higher degree of order, a higher level of complexification. Ilya Prigozhin and Eric Yonge and these guys figured that out years ago. Of course, they were denied because it screws up, you know, a lot of other people's thinking. But that is actually what happens. And change, when it occurs like that, is improbable and unpredictable. Well, Grandfather Martin, in front of all of us, there weren't very many of us, but in front of us, he said, through his nephew, Emery, he said, "It only takes one, maybe two. Three is too many." But he was saying that the butterfly effect is real, and that, you know, one person can do it. One person can do it, whatever it is. So, anyway, there you have it. It's Mike Hagan. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We're just sneaking up on 2 a.m. in the morning. I'm going to bow out of here, say goodbye to y'all, and thank y'all for listening in and participating in the program tonight. It was a pleasure, as always. Next week, we will have Neil Adams. We'll talk about the growing Earth theory. And in the meantime, we'll have one more here from this wonderful band that I've been featuring all night. They're called the Starlings. And I was fortunate enough to see them play the other night and get a copy of their disc. And this is the first song on it and the last one I'm going to play. It's called Hand to Mouth. And I hope you enjoy it. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. I think we're going to go off the air when I boogie out of here because no one has been able to come in tonight and relieve me, and I can't stick around tonight. I wish I could, but got things to do in the morning. So we'll say goodbye to you and catch up with you all next week. In the meantime, Hand to Mouth from the Starlings. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM.
Tell me a story about when you hit the road. Tell me a story what it's like to grow so old. Well, I know you've been hanging around hand to mouth. Would have liked to have seen you in your highest summer. Would have liked to have known you.